Good afternoon, and welcome to the Wilhelm Moll Rare Book and Medical History Room. Dr. Moll's portrait is right behind me, and his presence is always here with us. I'm Joan Echtenkamp-Klein, the Elvin V. and Nancy Baird Curator for Historical Collections here at the Claude Moore Health Sciences Library. And I'm delighted that you joined us for this presentation, which is the first for the spring semester of the 2005-2006 History of the Health Sciences Lecture Series. I hope to see you at other lectures this spring, too, as the upcoming lectures promise to be both interesting and informative. What are the historic roots of the close relationship between aviation and ophthalmology? We'll find out in March. And in April, we'll learn what's in a name, especially if that name happens to be Typhoid Mary. You will see these listed in your playbill, so please mark your calendars and plan to join us. I was thrilled when tonight's speaker, Margaret Humphreys from the School of Medicine and the Department of History at Duke University, accepted the invitation to participate in the lecture series. I will not do a lengthy introduction for her now, as the playbill contains biographical information, which I encourage you to read. I also encourage you to look into some of Dr. Humphreys' suggested readings, also in the playbill, as they will provide a broader context for this, of necessity, too brief a presentation. Margaret Humphreys is a well-known and well-respected historian of medicine. She is also a physician, so that brings clinical experience to her writing and her research. Her books, Yellow Fever in the South and Malaria, Poverty, Race, and Public Health in the United States, demonstrate her ability to focus on health concerns that at once seem to be uniquely connected to the South, yet have wide-ranging national implications. Dr. Humphreys' talk tonight is at once specific and sweeping in its scope. The health of black soldiers who entered the Union Army. In large numbers in 1863 and 1864, was of great concern and interest during the last few years of the Civil War. The newly minted soldiers were prey to diseases at alarming rates. What, if anything, did the seeming propensity to morbidity and mortality by African American soldiers mean during the Civil War? And were there any conclusions to be drawn about their health, or lack thereof, and its effect on citizenship in a post-war nation? I'll stop there and let Dr. Margaret Humphreys take us on a trip into the past.
Thank you, Joan. That's okay. Put my cough drops down. Brought my own disease with me today. So I apologize for the froggy voice. All right, now we can get our technology to cooperate. Okay. This started as part of a larger project on the history of medicine in the American Civil War. And I knew I was going to be interested in the black soldier because I've been interested in issues of race and medicine throughout my academic career. What I didn't expect was to find so much and to find such a rich trove of things to talk about that what was to be a book chapter has become a book. And I'm finding, as many people have before, that the Civil War is something of a bottomless pit, that once you enter, you just keep finding topic after rich topic to talk about. And today what I'm talking about is the importance of the health of black soldiers, both for themselves, obviously, for the war effort, but more broadly in how the fate of the races in America was interpreted in a time when things were changing very rapidly. The Civil War brought to the forefront questions of what was going to happen to all these people that had been enslaved, living under one whole system of life, when they became independent citizens, people who were no longer slaves. And even the most well-meaning had many questions about how this transition was going to happen. Could the black man become an independent citizen who supports himself, who works, doesn't just laze around, takes care of his family, maintains his health, behaves lawfully, and votes responsibly? There were those, particularly apologists for slavery, who said none of this could happen. The black man can only function well in society as a slave. Others ask if The black man was physically different from the white man in biologically important ways. Was he more prone to disease, more or less intelligent, more able to work in certain environments? If you made him a soldier, would he fight? Would he fight as well as the white man? And some even went so far to say, is he human, a man at all? Or was he a different species? Were black people sort of halfway between some sort of animals and real humans? What about mulattoes? Are they people who seem to have ancestry from white and black? Were they fertile? Were they healthy? Were they property? Or were they people? All these questions swirled during the 1840s and 1850s, and then the Civil War brought them to the immediate forefront of intellectual discourse. Now, just to show you that it wasn't the fringe few or those who disliked black people and were racist who argued about these questions, I present this quotation from Abraham Lincoln, which is actually a fairly famous one, and we could do a whole book on this quote and how it has been used and what it means. But the point being that Lincoln just assumes there's a physical difference between white and black, and that's something that everyone in his audience, in this case the Lincoln-Douglas debates, would take for granted. Now, the American Civil War brought new answers to all these questions. Is this working? Okay. A lot of things happened in 1862, but for the purposes of my talk, I'd like to focus on just a few of them. Refugee slaves freed themselves by walking into Union lines and forced the first discussion of emancipation. The reality that millions of slaves would soon be free raised all sorts of concerns in the North about qualifications for citizenship. Secretary of War Stanton created the American Freedmen's Inquiry Commission to ask questions like, will the black man take care of his wife? Do they even acknowledge marriage? They were just at the most basic level trying to understand what this new society was going to look like. And contraband policy, for the first time, put a union stamp on what was going to happen when the former slave walked into a Union military camp. Remember, the fugitive slave law is still in force, which says that this property has to be returned. General Butler in the Peninsula of Virginia made himself famous in 1862 by saying, these men are contraband of war. It's just like we captured a mule. He's not making a claim about, he's not really being nice. He's just saying, these guys are valuable property. If they get to our lines, we're going to keep them. They're contraband. This language was memorialized in this envelope and this cartoon. Come back here, you black rascal. Can't come back, know how, massa. This child's contraband. Contraband camps grew around Union Army camps. And as there were many problems with these camps, they were sort of classic refugee camps. Too many people, not enough food, not enough shelter. The army had never been designed to be running refugee camps. But as they could get organized, these black people were put to work, female and male, as cooks, teamsters, construction workers, wherever the North could find them jobs working for the army. In 1863, on January 1st, the famous Emancipation Proclamation was issued. Remember, it only freed slaves in territories over which Abraham Lincoln had no control. So it didn't free slaves, for example, in loyal Missouri, in Kentucky, in Maryland. But it did many things on the road toward total emancipation. And that spring, major conversations about let's put the black man in the army begin. And the first troops are enlisted, and the first battles are fought by black troops at Battery Wagner, that's the famous Glory Regiment, at Milliken's Bend and at Port Hudson in Louisiana. So the question seemed to be answered, yes, the black man would fight, and fight courageously. Most of you, perhaps if you know, some of you may know much about the black soldier, but most of you probably what you know comes from this movie with Matthew Broderick as Robert Gould Shaw, and Denzel Washington and Morgan Freeman, about the Massachusetts 54th Regiment, which in many ways was an atypical black regiment. I'll just stop there. Don't pay attention to this slide. It was atypical in that most of the men who enlisted were free. They were, if they had been slaves, they had run away at an earlier age or somehow escaped. They were led by abolitionist leaders who saw this as a great cause and who had their interest at heart. They came all from one state. They parade through downtown Boston to great cheering. This, as we'll see in a moment, is not at all what the typical black regiment looked like. By the end of 1863, more and more Northerners would come to agree that the black man, properly led by white officers, made a good soldier. And you begin to see in multiple places this mantra, slave to soldier to citizen. The conversation about how is this transition going to happen now includes the fact that if we put the slave in the army, we can make an American citizen out of him. Now this cartoon from Harper's Weekly, remember a northern publication with sympathy toward the war, has a black man saying to animals, "Ugh, get out, I ain't one of you no more, I's a man, I is." It reflects the conversation of the time of are black slaves property like cows or are they people? And increasingly they're saying, "I'm a man." Seems like an obvious thing to claim, but it's something that had to be fought for. Now, Frederick Douglass, also famous for making the point that if you put a black man in uniform, even if you take him off a plantation to do that, he has earned the right to citizenship in the United States. And I'll let Morgan Freeman read this quotation because he does it so much better than I do.
"Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters, U.S. Let him get an eagle on his buttons, musket on his shoulder, and bullets in his pockets. There's no power on earth which can deny that he has earned the right to citizenship in the United States."
Comes under fair use, copyright law, and just don't tell Ken Burns. Okay, the 24th U.S. Colored Troops flag echoed this sentiment. You see at the top, I'm not sure you can see in the back, but it says, "Let soldiers in war be citizens in peace." And many officers took this as their role, to turn slaves into citizens. So they had classrooms in the regiments. They had lessons in reading. They made sure that these men attended religious ceremonies. Often you had sort of the official religion going on in camp with the official chaplain of the army. And then the black troops might go off at night and have their own ceremonies, doing things their own way. But the idea was to try to use all these sort of traditional civilizing methods, the classroom, the church, to bring slaves to full manhood, as they thought of it at the time. Of course, not everybody agreed with that. Others ridiculed the whole idea that blacks could become fighting men. They said, "Oh, they're too childlike. So here's a little black child playing a soldier." Then others pointed out that all soldiers are like children. They're supposed to obey. They're not supposed to think for themselves. They're under the wise governance of their officers who act like parents. And they said, well, blacks like to march and sing, and they have good rhythm, and they do well because they were used to being obedient to whites. So one of the threads through all this is the discussion of who a soldier is. Is he a full man? There are Southerners who feel, was a famous diary, Sam Watson's diary in Tennessee, when the Bragg's army is not doing too well, and the men start talking about the fact they're being treated like slaves. They didn't sign on for this long. They had a forced reenlistment. They put people at the back in battles to keep the white troops from going backwards. They shot them if they went backwards. Talking about suddenly, you know, this soldier life, it's not so glorious after all, and what are we being treated like? Slaves. So it's a complicated question, what makes a man, what makes a soldier, what makes a citizen. And into all this mix comes the issues around the health of the black soldier. And this is where my research raises some new questions and integrates much of what I've said so far. You can find in other scholars such as Ira Berlin, Keith Wilson, and Joseph Glatthar, whose writings are in the little bibliography I gave you there. These broad questions about biological differences play directly into the question of citizenship and strength. In the contraband camps, these refugee camps, mortality rate was sometimes 25% a year. People were dying at a rapid rate. They didn't have enough housing, they didn't have enough clothing, they didn't have enough food. They were all crammed together, and so you get a nice germ soup. And not surprisingly, the mortality rates were very high. Black soldiers had very high rates of morbidity and mortality. The worst case was the 65th U.S. Colored Infantry. This, by the way, was their official designation, so I'll use U.S. Colored Infantry, USCI, or USCT for U.S. Colored Troops in these slides. They enrolled a little over 1,700 men, and 772 of those men died of disease. Many of them before the regiment could even get out of its mustering in station in St. Louis. This regiment saw no combat. All these men died of disease. So what did this mean? Is the black man physically weaker than the white? Were slavery's defenders right and the black man could not thrive in freedom? Black slave owners like to point that out as the war was going on, that, you know, once you see all these blacks who were in contraband camps or in the Union Army, they hear these statistics and they say, that's what we said would happen. So you can see how it plays into their rhetoric. Here are some statistics. I have had some audiences want to spend a lot of time on these statistics and what they mean. Just if you'll take it as a given that the blacks died of disease more than whites and more than they should have in terms of the amount of battle or non-battle they saw. But one in seven black troops died of disease during the war, and one in 17 white volunteers did. So something's going on that's different about about the black soldiers' experience in the war. They saw much less battle because of the way the deliberate decisions being made by the command structure, but that shouldn't give them the reason to die of disease at such a high rate. And here's another way to put it, 9-to-1 disease mortality to battle mortality versus the white volunteers of 2-to-1. So why this difference? Here's my slide on the Mass 54th I was looking for a minute ago, that of how they were different from other troops. And in addition, I should say that make the last point, that many of these men were literate and they had connections back home. They could advocate for themselves. And I think ability to self-advocate is one of the most important differences between the black troops and the white troops. White troops came often from the same town. They had people back home who could make a fuss. Often some large proportion of the men in the regiment could write. The governor of the state could get involved if things aren't going well. White troops had a lot of outlets for advocacy, complaint, and remedy. The Mass 54th, when things went bad with it, the governor of Massachusetts got involved. But there were very few state regiments of black troops. Most of them were national regiments gathered without, I mean, they were in a region, but they might put guys from Kentucky together with guys from Missouri and a few from St. Louis. They didn't have this single source bonding of coming from the same town, and their officers came from wherever. They also didn't come from the town, so they didn't have that sort of prior bond and ability to muster help from the outside. Now, this is a slide from Noah Trudeau's Like Men of War, Black Troops in the Civil War. I'm not sure if I put that on there, but I recommend it as well. Talking about where the black troops came from. As I said, the Glory Regiment was largely free blacks from in and around Boston. But 140,000 of the 180,000 or so black troops were actually ex-slaves. And they were recent ex-slaves. They had either just freed themselves and walked into Union lines, or they had been bought off plantations in Missouri and Kentucky and put straight into the army. They were men that were slaves last week or last month, and suddenly they're thrown into this new army environment. The Union Army did buy slaves off plantations, and if by 1864 you were a slaveholder in Kentucky and you didn't get the point that your property was about to not have any value in Kentucky, you were kind of missing the local news. But so there was a resistance to selling slaves, but also some slave owners who were pleased to take what the government was offering for black men. These men entered not with all the pride and knowledge and self-awareness of Denzel Washington and Morgan Freeman, but I think more so some of these pictures show a sense of dislocation, of unsureness, uncertainty. They didn't quite know what was happening to them. Most of them were illiterate. It had been illegal to teach slaves to read in most of the South. So this gave them decreased self-advocacy. Most of them arrived in camp malnourished, diseased, and poorly clothed. Those slave owners who sold their slaves took their good clothes off them and put them in the, you know, the least they could send them off being wearing because they were no longer their property. These men were often shipped for 3 or 4 or 5 days in unheated cattle cars to the assembly points, and they were often sick or malnourished before they even left. They were very poorly screened when they arrived. White soldiers who would have been rejected for hernias, joint problems, tuberculosis, other kinds of damage, were not, they didn't care as much about how the screening went. And there was no state association or external advocacy group for these men, by and large. They were treated throughout as second-class soldiers. They received lower pay, $7 a month versus $13, until that was changed in 1864. This left them less able to buy goods from the camp peddlers that could supplement the diet of white soldiers who had more money. And that's where men were able to get what fresh fruit and vegetables they had, because the army generally failed to supply it. They were given the poorest quality rations. Again, you could get away with it. It's only the black troops. They can't complain. They were given tents that one inspector felt had probably been sent back by white units as, you know, too shabby to be of use anymore, tents full of holes. Their clothing was of the poorest quality, and they were given poor quality firearms. They were sent into battle with guns that their officers knew didn't shoot. It took them a long time to get the best rifles. Again, the Mass 54th got them because they were a state unit and everybody bragged about when they were getting their infields. But many of the ex-slave regiments were given poor quality firearms. And then most of their officers were there for the promotion and the pay. And they weren't there because they were abolitionists who want to lead this, you know, brave new army of freed men. Their medical care was equally second class and shabby. They did not have enough doctors. Most of them are recruited in the middle of 1863 and 1864. By then, most of the docs who wanted to go to war had gone to war, and only so many were being produced anew from medical schools. So there just weren't enough doctors to go around, no matter how well-meaning people were. They didn't get as much medicine. Their supply of ordinary expected medicines was inadequate. Their hospitals were worse. They were dirtier. You might think that a Civil War hospital is dirty enough, but there were some that were fairly clean. And these guys' hospitals were more poorly managed. The diet in the hospital wasn't as good as it should have been. They got inadequate supplies, bandages, just ordinary things, underwear. And they also were not treated as white soldiers were in terms of furloughs, the right to go home for a while, or just rest when they felt sick. Now, the further problem was that how do you get white doctors to agree to take care of black men? And this General Lorenzo Thomas is one of the major recruiters of black troops in the Western Theater, Kentucky, Missouri, Tennessee. And he talks about in his papers in the National Archives that the subject of obtaining suitable medical officers for the Negro regiments has given me much uneasiness. Now, one proposal is that hospital stewards should be accepted as doctors. A hospital steward was more or less a pharmacist who may have had some training before the war working in a pharmacy, or he may have just been trained on the spot by some doctor in the Army to dispense medications, and along the way he'd get to know what medicines were good for what. Lorenzo Thomas said, we're not going to do that. You've got to have a medical degree to be, just like for the white regiments. And he's going to draw the line. But what happens, you see in the papers, he will hear about the case of so-and-so to be proposed as a surgeon for a regiment. He'll turn the guy down saying he doesn't have an MD degree. And then later on he'll get a letter saying that the general or the colonel of that regiment has approved the guy anyway. So even though some people tried to set standards, others just let inadequately trained people in. But that caused problems even for white people. General Nathaniel Banks was commanding general of the army in the Gulf Coast region in the last 2 years of the war. And people would complain about these doctors who weren't doctors, because a white person might have to be taken care of by them in the event of a battle or in other circumstances in a hospital. And that's no good. And he, too, tried to find medical, more medical officers. He sent a distinguished physician around to all the medical schools in the North, trying to get new docs or even medical students to sign up as surgeons. At least they'd have more experience than some of these other possibilities. We get very little by way of response or the particular experience the black soldiers had with these doctors, but there are a few letters that got out and got published, largely in the African-American press in the North. And one letter says, the doctors visits them about 3 times a week, which is not as often as you ought to be in the hospital, and they do more harm than good. They poison the soldiers. They are called doctors, but they are not. They are only students who knows nothing about issuing medicines. Now, some people in teaching hospitals may be upset about these students who are prescribing and knows nothing, but in these instances, this would reveal that the men knew they were substandard doctors, and they knew they ought to have better, but they had very little power to get things changed. So why don't we, if we're having trouble getting some white doctors, why don't we commission black doctors? There were a few in the United States before the Civil War, although there weren't very many. There were more who had trained in Canada in this particular case. Alexander Augusta trained in Toronto because he couldn't train in the United States. And he was perhaps the most famous first black doctor to apply to Lincoln here, January 7, 1863. I beg leave to apply to you for an appointment as surgeon to some of the colored regiments where I can be of use to my race. So Lincoln passed it down the chain of command to where it belonged. Augusta was examined, found to be perfectly well qualified, and appointed major and surgeon, which is what the rank of a surgeon was in the Army, in the middle of April 1863. Well, that sounds like a good idea. No problems there. We got a black doctor, black troops. This wrong is grave, unjust, and humiliating, said a white doctor. The problem is that whoever gets appointed... If Surgeon A is appointed and then Surgeon B is appointed later, Surgeon B is always outranked by Surgeon A because Surgeon A came in first. Now we have white officers being outranked by a black officer. This cannot stand. This thing of amalgamation or miscegenation in the appointment of officers, I do not believe in, said Assistant Surgeon. He's lower ranked than Augusta. Joel Morse too. Actually, John Sherman of Ohio, Senator John Sherman of Ohio, brother of William Tecumseh Sherman. There was big outrage over this among surgeons who were appointed after Augusta, but in that same group of medical officers. And the way that it was dealt with is they pulled Augusta out of the camp where he belonged for taking care of soldiers and sent him to Baltimore, where he ran the recruiting station examinations for black soldiers. And he actually received the brevet rank of lieutenant colonel and left the war with the highest ranking black officer in the Civil War. He goes on to lead a fight. He settled in Washington, D.C., and to lead the fight for black doctors to be accepted into the American Medical Association. He lost that fight, but he tried with some others. So he becomes a leader of American medicine, American black medicine after the war. So what they did to avoid this controversy is, instead of putting black doctors in as regular surgeons, they made them acting assistant surgeons or contract surgeons. There they have no commission, they have no rank that matters in terms of the Army's hierarchy, and they hired a few more people that way. But the treatment that Augusta got was well publicized in the black press, and indeed it was talked about on the floor of the Senate by Henry Wilson, who was a senator from Massachusetts, who always took a lead in the affairs of black troops. And so it must have dissuaded what few black doctors there were from even trying, because he was pretty well humiliated by this whole affair. So this is not going to be the answer. There were a few black doctors, but not very many. Anderson Abbott was one of them, who I happen to be able to find a picture of. To give you an example of the problems of getting doctors for black regiments, let's go back to that ill-fated 65th U.S. Colored Infantry, the one who had 700 men die of disease in 2 years of the war. The regiment was gathered in St. Louis and over the winter of 1863-64. A regiment, which is about 1,000 men, should have one full surgeon and two assistant surgeons. For the whole time, they only had four at all. The first surgeon number one was 1 year out of medical school, which is a very unusual level of inexpertise to be made a full surgeon. He was appointed January 1864, developed a hernia, was sick a lot of the spring, and was gone by the summer. Surgeon number two joined in April and died a month later of diarrhea. Surgeon three joined in August. Note, there's no doctor at all for this regimen for several months here. He quickly sickened. He left in November. Finally, they got a surgeon in August who lasted for the remaining time of the regimen. One guy. So this happened through, I mean, we happen to know these people better because one historian has focused on this regimen, but there weren't enough doctors. Well, so what? 19th century medical care was so bad that weren't you better off not having a doctor? Well, can't let that stand, that comment, can we? If you know from attending these lectures or your own work in the history of medicine, there were some very nasty treatments that were common during the mid-19th century. One of them was bloodletting, and this gadget here is a tool that has a spring that pops into a vein and lets the blood run out easily. And they had theories that bloodletting was good for pneumonia and other kinds of fevers and inflammation. They also used all sorts of drugs we'd consider poisons today, such as mercury, antimony, ipecac, and very harsh laxatives. Mercury, which of course causes mercury toxicity and poisoning, is also probably an antibiotic. So they weren't entirely insane in the use of these drugs, but they got a lot of toxic side effects on the way to getting any treatment at all. So perhaps you're better off without these things. But there were some things that doctors were important for. Some of it has to do with organization and management. Other is actual treatment. The first is field evacuation. And it took the Union Army a good year and a half to get this organized in terms of an adequate and planned ambulance corps. Ambulance meaning, you know, just getting the sick and the wounded off the field and into the hospital. In general, if you have men in camp, even if they aren't fighting, somebody has to be in charge of finding out who's sick, getting them to the hospital, organizing their care, getting them where they needed to go, and that was often the surgeon. So somebody just to look out for the health problems of the unit, or also to say to the commanding officer, the water supply needs to be further from the latrines. Simple things that they already knew made a difference to the health of units. Sorry about that. There were drugs that you would have been glad to have in the 1860s if you were in the Army. The first was quinine, used for the treatment of malaria. Although, unfortunately for black troops, there was a prevailing opinion that blacks didn't get malaria, or if they did, quinine didn't help them. So often, black troops did not receive the care they should have had, and the quinine was not properly supplied to them, so they didn't have it on hand. The second drug, chloroform or ether, both anesthetics were available. Fortunately for the Civil War, in the decade before the war started, and if you were having your leg cut off, this drug made a big difference. And the third was opium, for after you had your leg cut off, or for bad diarrhea. Opium's a very effective drug, and the doctor is the one who controlled the dispensing of it. Hospitals could make a difference, and a properly run hospital could make a difference. Even if you don't have antibiotics, to have a bed to rest in, a blanket to keep you warm, a person to bring you gruel and water, and to keep you cleaned up if you mess yourself, all these things make a difference in survival from disease, and hospitals could provide them, even if they didn't understand anything about the germ theory and that sort of thing. So a good doctor could run a hospital well, and they knew all about keeping hospitals clean. If nothing else, Florence Nightingale's books from the 1850s and the Crimean War were widely available and even circularized by the Army about proper hospital sanitation. So all this, if you had a good doctor who was paying attention, it mattered. And, of course, surgery itself could save lives and take some, too, as I say there. There wasn't any concept of antisepsis, of keeping things clean, or at least not at the level that would prevent infection. But the only thing for an open fracture or open damage from a rifle ball was to amputate the limb. So if you have it, either a surgeon knows how to do it or they don't. And you'll see the exams in the Civil War were very heavily focused on anatomy. How do you tie off the femoral artery? What do you do to control bleeding in an arm? Where are the arteries and what do you do about them? And a well-trained doctor from even a fairly minimal medical school should know those things. A couple of points to make here. If a guy gets sick while he's in the Army, he's supposed to be doing sentry duty, or he's out building a fortification or something like that, and he gets sick, he wants to stop working, right? You want to give him a rest. He's got a fever of 104. You ought to put him to bed. But a medical doctor has to make that decision. Just as, you know, if you're a worker today and you need time off for debility or whatnot, you may need a doctor's certificate. Well, it's a similar thing there. And there are some complaints, some anecdotal evidence that white doctors were far less ready to listen to these complaints from black soldiers. They tended to adapt the southern slaveholder attitude that, well, these guys are lazy, they're just faking it, they just want to get off work. And so they didn't listen in the same way they would have to a white guy from their own town who they've known, you know, for years, who they know their daddy. You know, it's a different kind of communication, and the medical officers controlled that line to rest and to furloughs, as I mentioned before. As units got sicker and sicker, and many of these black units had very high sick lists, it got harder to get sick time. Because if, you know, half the unit's already in bed, now you want time off, you're not going to get it as likely as if everybody was well. The U.S. colored troops were put to harder physical work. The expectation was that these men who'd just been slaves could do more physical work in the daytime, in a given day, than white troops would be expected to do. So they were worked harder. They weren't fed anymore. They didn't get extra clothes. They just did all this heavy labor. Finally, one thing a doctor could do was to call for help from the U.S. Sanitary Commission. Now, the U.S. Sanitary Commission was a quasi-governmental organization, sort of like the Red Cross would become, that helped get things to soldiers that they needed. They might, for example, send a shipment of underwear or blankets or other kind of clothing to a unit that didn't have enough. They might send food to, and particularly anti-scurvy foods, onions and potatoes. They didn't know what was in them, but they knew it prevented scurvy. Somebody had to call them, though, and say, gee, we're seeing scurvy in our unit. We need some help. The Sanitary Commission would also help provide nursing and other kinds of help in the hospitals. They might even provide medications. They could provide bandages. They were a funnel for the sort of relief effort of the North. All those women who wanted to knit socks and make quilts, instead of just randomly sending them or sending them to their own regiment, what happened is they would send them to the Sanitary Commission, who would then distribute them. But if you need somebody who cares enough about the troops to call the Sanitary Commission to say, come help us. And the black troops didn't always have that sort of empathy from their officers or their medical officers. Now, epidemiology here, spread of infectious diseases. It's bad enough to do it, have it amplified. A further thing to realize is that, if you remember, 140,000 of these men came directly from plantations. They lived before the war in fairly isolated rural settings, just like many of the soldiers, the white soldiers in the war. These men, therefore, had not seen diseases that would hit them pretty much as soon as they walked into a barracks. One was measles, one was smallpox, other meningitis, and many of just that panoply of upper respiratory infections that my son is now getting in preschool. These men are all seeing them as adults, and often these diseases are worse in an adult than it is in a small child. They also often are walking into situations where the water supply is contaminated by fecal material, and so all the viruses as well as the familiar bacteria were spread. So they got a sort of multiple whammy here. One, just having rural to urban, which is essentially what they're doing, walking into civil war camps. The second is just they're in crowds, whether they've been urban before or not, they're in crowds with greater chance of spreading disease. And then third was this idea I think I mentioned before that black people don't get malaria. So if we need to have troops garrisoning spots in malarious areas, let's put the black troops there. So they did. They stationed them all along the lower Mississippi, which is one of the most malarious areas in the country, and falciparum malaria, the kind that kills people. They particularly favored black troops in South Carolina and sending them into Florida. well, black people do get malaria, and they do die of falciparum malaria. And these men were then specifically put in harm's way with the thought that they better them than the white troops. I want to talk about several specific places, and if you're interested, I can come back and talk more about these. One of the great sites of dying, if you will, of the black troops was at Benton Barracks in St. Louis between 1863 and 1864. It was a gathering point for recruits from Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee. The housing was grossly inadequate for the white troops that were there, and then they started piling in black troops. So the roofs leaked, and it was very cold that winter. The river froze at St. Louis. They couldn't get coal from Illinois because the river was frozen. That frozen river and the frozen Missouri River also blocked shipments of food to St. Louis in the quantity that was needed. Many of the regiments were brand new. They weren't even regiments really yet. They were just crowds of men. They didn't have doctors. The system wasn't ready for them. And rampant diseases appear at this time. Cerebral spinal meningitis, probably meningococcal meningitis from the description. Pneumonias, smallpox, measles, with a high level of mortality. Now, you may not think that measles should matter that much, but measles matters for a couple of reasons. First of all, the measles mortality rate here looks like what measles looks like in Africa now, not what it looked like perhaps in your childhood if you remember back that far and your mother had measles parties like mine did so that everybody would get it. This is measles with a high level of pneumonia following the initial disease. And also, measles leaves your immune system depressed, so that if you're around people with all these other diseases, you're going to get a secondary infection. So it's almost like measles sets up sort of an AIDS-like situation, that now your immune system's down and they're surrounded by all these other diseases, that many of them got sick and died. So that was Benton Barracks. And we're going to hear a bit from a fellow who was doing research there, and we'll come back to that in a few moments. A second place that was particularly high in mortality was Port Hudson, Louisiana. It had been the site of one of the famous Black Regiment Civil War battles, but once they freed up the Mississippi in this area, they left black troops to guard the river. It was a highly malarious area, and that falciparum malaria, the kind that has a high mortality rate. The black troops were camped in an area with a high water table. Think about, say, the area around New Orleans where they can't sink wells because the water table is just right there under the water. Well, so was all the fecal material from these troops and these regiments. Some men were camped actually on the burying ground from the Port Hudson battle, and so they were trying to sink wells through graves. The final point is that although Louisiana is an area that's growing tropical fruits and vegetables, they could see orange trees from the banks of the Mississippi here. The black troops generally did not go out foraging into the communities for a variety of reasons, which we could talk about if you want to, but they were left there sort of cooped up in their garrison right on the river and developed scurvy amidst this land of tropical fruits and vegetables. A third story or case that where things went particularly bad was at Brazos, Santiago, Texas, in the summer of 1865. Now, the war's over, you think. Well, that's sort of a modern perspective on it. If you've read that book called April 1865, whereas we think of, well, the war's winding down, everything's over with, instead, nobody really knew the way things were going to go. And one question had to do with the stability of Mexico and whether that we needed troops on the border with Mexico and Texas. Many of the Confederate soldiers at least tried to escape to Texas with the hope of sort of preserving the Confederacy there, starting over. There was worry about it being a guerrilla stronghold. And so the decision was made in April and May to send large numbers of troops, 40,000 troops, to the Texas-Mexico border. But who to send? Well, these black troops had signed up for 3 years in the middle of winter of 1863-64, the spring of 64. They still had time to serve, and the white troops wanted to go home. Of course, the black troops did too, but they didn't have quite the political constituency. So many of the troops that were sent were black. They were camping out on little barrier islands without adequate water. They actually sent a water condensation machine there to convert salt water to drinkable water. Apparently it was very wretched tasting. And they didn't send, after a war in which 4 years everybody knew about scurvy, they'd been raising money all over the north to buy fruits and vegetables for the troops. There was no excuse for it. They did not send adequate fruits and vegetables with these men. There was no local purchase possible. And scurvy breaks out affecting anything from like 60 to 80% of the troops. And many of them died. Even when they went in the hospital, where they should have gotten the kind of foods that would cure their scurvy. There's description of men being fed crackers and coffee, very hard crackers called hardtack. And there's a horrible description of the blood from the bleeding gums of scurvy trickling down the hardtack as the men tried to eat it. So it just exemplifies how poorly these men were treated because they didn't have the self-advocacy or the political power to fight back. One man did write a letter to a northern black newspaper, and it was scoffed at mildly when it first appeared. There was one officer wrote a counter letter and published in the same newspaper. But when that article was then reprinted, that first thing was published in Philadelphia, but it was reprinted in Galveston, and it got a lot of local attention. Then the Army got all hot and bothered, tried to find the guy who wrote the letter, who'd used a pseudonym, said they were going to court-martial him, couldn't find him. A doctor also in Texas that summer wrote to the Surgeon General saying, this is a scandal and the doctors down here are mistreating the men. We desperately need foods to treat scurvy. And the reaction to him was to be attacked and brought up for court-martial by those local doctors who he had described as misbehaving. And he was indeed court-martialed and booted out of the Army. So the degree of callousness is not accidental, and it's pretty damning in retrospect. So, back to sort of the intellectual discussion of the black man, his health, and what it meant. First of all these dead black soldiers unfortunately gave fodder for autopsy studies, which was one of the main ways to do medical research in the 1860s. White doctors saw a lot of disease in black men and were able to assess differences in things they were interested in, susceptibility, virulence, response to treatment. And it also becomes part of a general quest at the time to determine normal human measurements and to assess ethnic differences. Now, the first way I want to talk about briefly to study the black soldier are autopsy records. These records are from Benton Barracks in St. Louis. They were kept by a man named Ira Russell, who was a man very sympathetic to the black soldier, who fought a lot of fights for him in St. Louis trying to make things better. But he also did a lot of research on them. And this is a spreadsheet. Obviously, you can't tell any details much, except that the name is down here on the left, and I'm going to give you some pieces of it more close up. There's name. Can I do this? Rank. The regiment. The company. Now, this one is very interesting. I don't know if you can read it or not, but it's color. And look at the colors. 1/8 white, 3/8 white, 1/4 white. He's fascinated by differences in supposed mixture of white and black and the degree to which that might affect how their disease turns out. There are almost no completely black people in the first round of Ira's exams, the first 200 or so, which in part confirms what Joel Williamson has argued, that the race mixing in the West, in Missouri, in this area, was far that sadly enough, that people in the East sold their children to get them out from sight and sent them to the Western states in this time. And you see age and height there. These two blurry things are, this one is then turned. So under brain, he lists spinal canal, effusion into ventricle, effusion into arachnoids, condition, and weight. To give you an idea of what he was writing down on each of these men. Then in this line, we have heart, right lung, left lung, liver, spleen, stomach, and intestines. And there'd be some sort of qualitative comment at times. Others of these things are carefully weighed, like the liver and the spleen. So the survey was one method to do this. And Ira doesn't really draw much of a conclusion from those records, but others will. In just a moment, we'll talk about it. The second was to do a survey of doctors who had treated the black soldier, and that's the handout that I had out front with this series of questions. And the U.S. Sanitary Commission starts asking these questions and sending around these surveys in 1863. And their version of it was 3 or 4 pages with little blank spaces left between the questions to ask for the doctor to fill in. So they ask questions like, why are these soldiers so weak? Why are they dying so abundantly? Are they susceptible to particular diseases? Do they respond to therapy differently? And does mixed race make any difference in these questions? A third way they studied the black body was to actually physically measure it. This work by Benjamin Apthorpe Gould is fairly famous. It was published in 1869. He studied both Union troops both black and white, and measured all sorts of things: height, weight, various lengths. Like, he was interested in the length from the tip of the fingers to the knee. Now, you might wonder why anybody would care about the difference between the tip of the fingers to the knee, but apparently he found racial differences, that black arms are longer compared to the trunk than white arms. And so, being a 19th century ethnologist, he said, well, that just goes to show that black people are closer to apes than white people. They could find a way to make some sort of a racial differentiation on the basis of something, they would. He had a crude spirometer and did lung capacity, and he did measures of strength and endurance, of having them lift weights and that sort of thing. So they gathered all this data, and what did they conclude about why black soldiers died more than whites? Well, this is from the official report by the Provost Marshal General on the health of the troops in the war that came out right after the war, 1867. And he concludes... He looks like a fun guy. I always like his picture here. The Negro, in the condition in which the war found him, was less able than the white to endure the exposures and annoyances of military service. It is merely suggested that it is moral rather than physical that the great susceptibility of the colored man to disease rose from lack of heart, hope, and mental activity. And then Fry goes on to claim, this view is supported by the opinions of surgeons of boards of enrollment on the abstract question of the physical fitness of the colored men examined by them. So Fry is claiming, and as would others, that it's some sort of lack of mental strength that's causing this weakness to disease. In fact, that last quotation about the surgeons at examining boards is entirely contradicted by his own office's publication 10 years later, where you have the opinions of those surgeons, many of them summarized in this big book about the health of the recruits. And they actually thought the black guys were healthier than the white guys they were seeing, but this largely in northern cities, the people who responded. But anyway, here's the assumption that somehow it's moral strength that is wanting. Roberts Bartholow, a big name in 19th century medicine, said he too says the Negro is less enduring, less active, vigilant, enterprising, more given to malingering. Sort of basically echoing the slave owner's opinion about how black people would be. But Ira Russell, our friend in St. Louis, who did a lot of those autopsies, but also fought for the black soldier to get him proper care, said it is often said, even by surgeons in charge of colored regiments, that it is of no use to doctor a sick Negro, that he will die, do what you may. I am satisfied that no greater a mistake can be committed. When I hear a surgeon making such a statement, I regard it as evidence of culpable indifference and neglect. I like Ira, you can probably tell that. Among no class of patients have I seen better results from treatment than among colored soldiers when proper care and study has been given to their disease. So there are a few people who say, if you treat them well, they do just as well as white people. But that was a minority voice. The one publication that comes out of the Sanitary Commission survey and Ira's autopsy statistics is an article in the Anthropological Review published in 1869 by Sanford Hunt. And why he wrote it and not Ira, I don't know, although he quotes Ira in there and quotes things that are in the manuscript collection of the Sanitary Commission. Sanford Hunt pointed out that blacks appeared to be more susceptible to pneumonia, that their lungs were smaller, and Gould had reported the smaller lungs as well. But he was surprised to find lower TB rates than expected. Everybody was sure that blacks got more TB than whites. The war showed that the blacks were equally susceptible to malaria. And we could talk about malaria immunities in discussion if you want to, but in the war they got it just as well as white guys. Infamously, they found the average black brain was smaller than white by 5 ounces. And much of all the statistics and all this data, that's the one that survives in anthropology through the end of the 19th century. And overall, you get the impression they gathered lots of data with very little results. What they believed before the war, they believed after the war. So instead of seeing the disease mortality of black soldiers in the Civil War as an indictment of their treatment by the Union Army, most contemporary observers concluded that the black man was intrinsically weaker than the white. This argument presaged assumptions about racial degeneration that would follow later in the century. And it is a convoluted argument because you have to be able to say, well, blacks have less endurance than whites. Well, that seems surprising given what sort of work they were doing on Mississippi cotton plantations as slaves versus being soldiers. But they made that endurance into a mental trait, an ability to stay mentally strong, and then hung all the other physical events on that. Now, the title, which you may wonder, is she ever going to get to Intensely Human, since that's my title, comes from an exchange that happened in South Carolina between two abolitionist officers very sympathetic to the black soldier. Colonel Thomas W. Higginson was talking to General Rufus B. Saxton, and they had that questionnaire that you have in front of them. And Higginson remembers it this way. General Saxton, examining with some impatience a long list of questions from some philanthropic commission at the North respecting the traits and habits of the freedmen, bade some staff officer answer them all in two words, intensely human. We all admitted that was a striking and comprehensive description. Thank you. I should say in Philadelphia, where I gave this talk this fall, several black reenactors came, guys dressed in their Civil War uniforms. So that was a unique experience in talking to people like they could tell me and I should just shut up. But it's been a very interesting experience talking about this in a variety of venues. So questions, comments, clarifications?